This is an ABC podcast. Hello, Natasha Mitchell with you. Welcome. Now, what if you suddenly found out you weren't quite who you thought you were? On Science Friction this month, we've been diving into all sorts of vexed and very personal stories from the world of assisted reproductive technology. The hopes, the hard decisions, the unanticipated consequences and the ethical dilemmas. So we brought you that extraordinary tale of two embryos and their millionaire parents. Then we heard from two women, each grappling with what to do with the unused frozen embryos they still have stored at IVF clinics. Well, today it is Matty's story, and ABC Science reporter Anna Saleh joins me. Anna, you met Matty and Matty's mum, Evelyn, at the recent Fertility Society of Australia conference in Hobart.
Yeah, Matty was conceived using donor sperm and was fielding questions about their experience at this meeting of infertility counsellors. And Matty's mum, Evelyn, was also in the room, and I have to tell you, it was such a moving experience.
And the family agreed to share their stories with you and I for the first time publicly right here on Science Friction. You're about to hear what impact keeping a secret like donor conception can have on a family.
And our story starts in January 1984 in a hospital ward in Perth. 27-year-old Evelyn is cradling her newborn baby in her arms for the first time.
When Matty was actually born, that was probably the most amazing moment in my whole life. That first hold of Matty. So that was pretty special.
Very special because I was at the birth. Evelyn had the natural birth.
That's Tony, Evelyn's husband.
Once the gynecologist got the head and the shoulders out, he said, "Right, Dad, you do the rest." Yeah. So I played a big part in the births, and I'm very happy and proud of that. Yeah.
Evelyn says she always wanted to have children, but because Tony was infertile, he had a medical condition from boyhood, the couple opted to use sperm from an anonymous donor instead.
We both came from big families, and I think we were very family orientated sort of thing, and I thought, yeah, give it a go. And I regard us both fortunate to have this opportunity with this artificial insemination. I can't recall any counselling or anything about the consequences and everything.
For Evelyn, it wasn't an easy decision.
I was brought up a Catholic, and even though I wasn't a practising Catholic, I'm not a Catholic or religious, but it was still obviously had that bit of a hold in my head. The sense that possibly this wasn't okay to do this wasn't somehow ethical.
And there were other worries too, like what if the sperm donor had helped create other children? Who were Matty's genetic siblings?
Perth is a fairly small place, and it was then. What if other people are doing this and there'll be other children, and what if they meet? That thought was also very early in my head.
This was the early 1980s, and going off to the doctor to be inseminated by a stranger's sperm was not something you talked about. The main focus here was on protecting the adults involved from things like unwelcome child maintenance or estate claims that might come later. As long as the resulting children grew up in a loving family, it was assumed they'd be okay. As for Evelyn, back then, the identity of the sperm donor was a case of out of sight, out of mind.
I didn't need to know. I just accepted it, I think.
A couple of years after Matty was born, Evelyn and Tony had another child, Beth, this time using sperm from a different anonymous donor. As the two children grew up, Evelyn wrestled with telling them they'd been donor conceived.
I had no one to talk to about it. Some people would say, keep this a secret. Other people might say, perhaps, they should know. But at the end of the day, it's our decision, I suppose, as the parents.
In the early years, I was feeling a bit reluctant, a little bit nervous, just the thought of telling them that I wasn't their biological father, simple as that, yeah. That was a thought, and I think in both Evan and I, that there might be a bit of a rejection there, but yeah, there could be, they could not be happy with it. And so I think you tell a 6-year-old or an 8-year-old, they might rebel on that. It might be, you know, it might be heartache.
But the struggle was there for me. Their dad felt this way. I felt a different way and wondered what was best for them. But it never seemed the right time either, the age difference and the place they were at in their development, and is this a good time and isn't it a good time?
So Maddie and Beth remained oblivious to their backstory. They grew up in Perth, and though their parents eventually separated, things kept chugging along well with a shared custody arrangement. But even as a child, something was niggling Maddie. So let's now bring Maddie into this story.
So I can remember being 5 or 6 years old at family gatherings asking my parents, is Dad my real dad? And their answer was, yeah, he's your father. The reason that I asked that question was because I don't look like the rest of my family. I have red hair and freckles. And growing up, I can remember looking at family photos and wondering where I got my red hair and freckles from.
Evelyn had answers at the ready for Maddie's questions.
And my natural colour is pretty much this brown, but in summer I get real red tint. So there's some red there.
People used to say when Matthew was 2 or 3, he said, he's very much like his dad. That's the response of people, regardless of having red hair. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't worry about Matthew being red hair or anything.
And there were redheads in Tony's side of the family. So we kind of used that. And I guess now, respectively, Maddie sees that as being lied to, which in essence it was. Yeah, these are the hard things for me now, to think of all the opportunities we had to do this a little bit differently and didn't take. And so there's some regret around those sorts of things.
So now we come to Maddie at 18, getting ready to launch into adult life. They, that's Maddie, by the way. Today, Maddie prefers the gender-neutral pronoun they. They were about to move out of home into a share house and head off to uni. And it was at this point Evelyn wanted to tell Maddie and younger sister Beth that they'd been conceived using donor sperm.
And I actually said, I'm going to tell Maddie before they leave home. You can be part of that or not.
So they call a family meeting.
Mum's like, Dad's coming around and we're going to have a family chat. And so Dad comes around and my parents are really nervous. And so that was pretty strange for us.
Oh, yeah, I was a little bit nervous, but we knew what we had to do many years ago. And as you get closer to it, you get a bit nervous. But I was relatively relaxed, but just wondering what their reaction would be.
Sat around the kitchen table and I felt very anxious. I felt very emotional. But I guess my memory of it is, we wanted to, it's a long time, probably overdue. I don't know quite what I said, but told them.
And so they sat us down and told us that we were both born from donor sperm.
Maddie didn't say very much at all from my memory at the time.
In fact, a whole lot was going through Maddie's head in that moment.
My parents were scared and I was angry because I felt like I'd been deceived for 18 years.
And yet, in that moment, somehow Maddie managed to be more concerned about Mum and Dad's feelings.
Because my parents were so scared of rejection, I felt that I had to manage them through that. And so I told them, it's fine. You've always been here for us. And this won't change anything. But at the same time, I was feeling that anger and betrayal.
I felt a little bit sadness for that, but I don't blame them for being angry. But at the end of the day, we were honest with them and told them at what we thought was the best time in their life to tell them, to give them their true identity.
But 17 years later, now 35 years old and living in Hobart, Maddie still feels the impact of that night, the anger, but also the sense of loss.
So my biological father, I didn't know who he was, and I had no way of finding out. And so the decision that my parents made back in 83 to use donor sperm meant that I would never have that connection. I would never have that knowledge. I would never be able to see where I'd come from.
On Science Friction, this is the story of Matty and family and the impacts of being told in adulthood that you were conceived with donor sperm. Natasha Mitchell this week joined by ABC Science reporter Anna Saleh.
And to get more insight into what Matty's going through, I caught up with Kate Bourne. She's got 2 decades of experience counselling donor-conceived people and their families.
The impact is often about a lack of trust and the impact on your identity when you think that you know who you are and then suddenly the foundation stone from that is different. So it's such a shock and it results in having to sort of review your identity.
Kate is a counsellor with the Victorian Assisted Reproductive Treatment Authority, or VARTA, and she says strategies to help donor-conceived people have lagged behind those for adoptees.
Yeah, this is really interesting, isn't it, Anna? Because, in fact, around the time Matty was born, people were really starting to understand the impact of secrecy on adopted children, that it was really better for their well-being if kids were told their biological origins when they were still really young.
And also, it was understood that secrecy could lead to distrust and a shaken sense of identity for people later in life.
But for some reason then, people didn't think that this applied to donor-conceived children. Why is that?
Well, one idea is that when doctors started using anonymous sperm donation in the 70s, that was to treat male infertility, it was kind of seen as a technical fix, you know, for a medical problem. And they didn't give enough attention to all those other impacts.
So many other impacts.
So, you know, the gentleman has a male factor infertility issue. And so, you know, we just treat that with some sperm from somebody else. And then the problem has been resolved in a kind of scientific way, rather than seeing that there were major psychosocial implications. So I don't think people really thought about the person conceived from the donation treatment and what their needs might be. There was a real focus on that couple who were desperate to have a child.
According to Kate Bourne, another reason for secrecy surrounding donor conception was the stigma surrounding male infertility.
For a man to be diagnosed with male infertility was very, very difficult and emasculating, and it was just thought things can be kept a secret, love is enough, and basically no one ever needs to know. And that sort of protected the man in particular, but also it was thought to protect the couple and the child. We hear stories of couples saying, the doctor even said, you know, go home, make love to your wife, and you know, we'll never really know who is the genetic father. So it was very much the way things were done then.
But back to Matty, because this story is about the donor-conceived children and what happens when they grow up. One of the biggest issues Matty struggled to reconcile was the way Matty's parents had skirted around the truth.
And even when I'd asked questions directly, the whole truth hadn't been said. And it took a long time to process that.
Matty would have preferred to have had their questions answered truthfully, even as a child. But Matty's dad, Tony, sees it differently.
And I don't regret telling Matthew and Beth at that age. I think it was the right move, I think. Because at the end of the day, we weren't lying to them. I think we were honest with them and to tell them at the appropriate time in their lives.
After the family revelation around the kitchen table, Matty struggled to get Dad to talk about the issue further and felt something was going to have to change in their relationship.
And it wasn't until 5 or 6 years ago I sat down with him and we had a conversation where I basically said, we're not related and I need you to acknowledge that. And he did.
And how was that?
There was a lot of tears. I think it was very difficult for both of us. because I was carrying that anger. And oh, how did we talk about it? It was something like, "Dad, we're not father and child here. We're something else." And he said, "What, like super friends?" And that's when things changed for us.
In what way?
That we could build a relationship based on the truth.
Right. Yeah.
And that's when they were able to develop a kind of new normal.
What happened after that conversation is it became okay for us to talk about how we were different to most families. And the special relationship between a father who's brought you up without having a biological connection and has always been there is a really special one. And that became a point of pride for my dad.
As you can imagine, Matty has also been curious about the identity of their donor. And after a long and complicated process involving DNA testing and searching on social media, Matty finally made a connection last year with biological father, Alan.
When I saw the first picture of Alan, it was immediately obvious to me that we were related. So I felt a connection, and that was scary because, well, basically it's like, oh my God, this explains a lot about who I am. But now that I've seen the picture, what are we going to talk about? What do I want to know? What do we have in common? What don't we have in common? Will I be rejected if I approach?
Matty and Alan haven't met in person yet, but they've been getting to know each other slowly using Messenger and Skype.
It's put a lot of pieces into place. Alan studied engineering. I got my interest in taking things apart and putting things together from there, and we share a sense of humour, and we also share a fervour for robust discussion. And so that process has been really exciting, but I'm still scared that by building this relationship, I might be pushing my father away.
What Maddie's been worried about is how Dad Tony will feel about all this. After all, he's the man who raised and loved him.
So I'm putting off going back home because I'm scared of hurting my father, and I'm scared of being rejected by my biological father, but I'm also really excited to go back because of the opportunity to build those relationships.
So what would you say to your dad if he was listening to this?
Love you, Dad. What would I say to him? Well, he always asks me when I'm coming home to see him. My biological father is also in Western Australia, and so I do want to see you soon, is what I would say to him.
It's only this past week, in fact, Matty has told Tony about finding biological father Alan.
Yeah, so this is extraordinary, Anna. This story has actually been unfolding for the family as we've been making this program.
I know. I was really heartened to hear that when you caught up with Tony on Tuesday, that he wanted Matty to know he supports whatever comes next, and he's even happy to meet Alan.
Instantaneously, I was very happy. Simple as that, I was very happy for him. The name's my surname, but in reality, I'm not a biological father, so.
But you are their father.
I am their father, yeah.
And has that remained very clear for you? You are dad?
I'm dad, yeah. As far as I'm concerned, I'm dad. I love them both, and yeah, because I've been with them all their lives, and it's naturally that you feel that you've got a bond between you. Fond memories, photos of them and what they did and their birthdays. And, yeah, just the most important thing for me and Evelyn was to bring them up and look out, give them kindness and love and care, send them down the right road, and we're both very proud of them to this day. they've turned into responsible young adults. I get a card of Beth and Matthew every year, and I got a card last year for Father's Day, and of this year, yeah, in September. And the card says on the front, 100% dad.
Oh, how did you feel about that?
Oh, I was quite, yeah, quite chuffed about that, yeah, yeah.
And Maddie's mum, Evelyn, where's she at in this whole process?
It's a work in progress for all of us, and it probably always will be. I wouldn't be without them. I do regret that it's been hard. Yeah, and the reason I guess I'm here today is because I want to support them in any way that I can to make the changes that they want to make.
I've had a lot of conversations with my parents about this stuff, and we've come to peace. But I've lost 30-odd years of being able to grow knowing where I've come from, and that's not something that I can ever get back. It's a lot easier to say I'm angry at a system that sort of allowed and supported non-disclosure back when I was conceived. And not just the assisted reproductive industry, but more broadly, society that places so much value on fertility. A lot of people believe that if you're unable to have a child of your own, that makes you somehow less than other people. And so those pressures also were part of my parents' decision.
Maddie was born in 1984. Today, the system better understands the impacts of secrecy or non-disclosure on donor-conceived people. Kate Bourne, counsellor with the Victorian Assisted Reproductive Treatment Authority, VARTA.
The recommendation has gone from medical staff encouraging not to tell to actually encouraging parents to tell. There's been studies that shows that families are closer when they talk to their children, and then in fact it's actually better for them to grow up knowing. And we've also found the hard way, because these days this sort of secret is often impossible to keep because of the direct-to-consumer DNA testing that is so widely available and used now. So the recommendation from mental health professionals across the globe is that it's better to start the conversation while the child's very young, so that they can't ever really remember a time where they didn't know. And so it's going to be quite normal for the children. This is just part of who they are and part of their family story. But it's families haven't missed the boat if they haven't, you know, told by a certain age. Certainly it's never too late to tell their son or daughter. And it's about thinking about how to do that in a loving and supportive way.
Last words go to Matty with some heartfelt thoughts for those of you who choose to go down the path of donor conception.
Be really clear and honest with yourself why you want to have kids, and realize that when you make the decision to use a donation, you're separating your child from that kin. People deal with that reality in different ways. A lot of the time, people like me are angry that they've been separated, and we're often told that we should be grateful for being here, and we get asked, would you prefer it if you were never born? And so if you want to go down this road, you'll get a lot out of it. You'll be able to parent and you'll be able to have a kid. But just realize that you might have to deal with the reality of the person that you've created and their feelings as they grow. We used to sweep all this stuff under the rug, keep it hush-hush, don't talk about this stuff. But if we know what's going on, who we're related to, we don't have to hide who we are. That's both powerful and freeing.
And our thanks to Maddie and parents Evelyn and Tony for sharing their story with us for the first time. It was a really big deal and we are so grateful to them.
Absolutely. And in further news, Matty and Sister Beth, she's now an activist for Donor Conceived People in Perth, they're both travelling to Geneva in November to speak at an event on the 30th anniversary of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child.
What a wild ride this has all been for them. Thank you for joining us, Anna.
And thank you.
Science journalist by day, bossa nova singer by night, people. You can talk to me on Twitter. I'm at Natasha Mitchell.
And I'm at Anna Saleh ABC.
And you can email us from the Science Friction website. Catch you soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.